Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Suzanne Braun Levine. Suzanne is a nationally recognized authority on women and family issues and media. She was the first editor of Ms. Magazine and the only woman to edit the Columbia Journalism Review. She produced the Peabody Award-winning documentary, She's Nobody's Baby, American Women in the 20th Century. Levine writes and blogs regularly on Feisty Side of 50, The Transition Network, The Third Age, Vibrant Nation, She Writes, and other popular sites for women, and is a contributing editor to More magazine. She's on the board of Civic Ventures, a nonprofit think tank on boomers, work, and social purpose. She's the author of Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood, and 50 is the New 50, 10 Life Lessons for Women in Second Adulthood. Her newest book was published in January 2012. She's a lecturer and advisor to several women's organizations dealing with midlife issues, and has appeared on Oprah, Charlie Rose, Today, NPR, and numerous other television and radio programs. Her previous books include Father Courage, What Happens When Men Put Family First, and An Oral History of Bella Abzug with Mary Tom, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2007. So now it's time for us to warmly welcome Suzanne Braun Levine. Thank you.
Thank you. I have to put this on. Listening to that introduction, I realize how passé the 20th century is. Is that a riot? I mean, thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Civic Ventures. Thank you, TTN. Thank you, Coming of Age. It's wonderful the way these different groups are coalescing around the very important movement to recognize the power, the passion, and the capabilities of people who are over 50. Over 50. We all think of our 50th birthday as a milestone, the big 5-0, and we decide whether to do a party or whether to run away and hide. But when we say a milestone, what exactly do we mean? A milestone of what? Is it the beginning of the end, as conventional wisdom suggests? Are lapsing memories spreading waistlines and lost fertility seem to suggest it is? Or is it the beginning of the beginning? Many women, I am among them, feel that we are coming into the height of our powers and are very anxious to see what the years after 50 hold. Now, I just want to stop for a minute and say there's so many male faces in the room that I'm really, although I speak about women and to women, I'm going to be really interested in your feedback when we get to the conversation part. So is it the beginning of the beginning or the beginning of the end? It's a little of both, actually, which is why we so often feel both elated and dazed and confused. The easy response to this existential bewilderment from friends, from husbands, from doctors, even from ourselves, is that this is just a passing case of menopausal madness. That's not true. It's not going to pass. The restlessness and confusion, the mix of hope and despair, signals a life transition as profound and far-reaching as adolescence. In both cases, hormones are raging, relationships are in turmoil, and we are asking ourselves who we are, what matters to us, and how we are going to be engaged in the world. The unknowingness can be maddening, but pushing against it only makes things worse. If you think this passage is going to be easy or quick, just think of your own adolescence or that of your children. No generation before ours has had to face this transition. We are the first to contemplate the prospect of as many years ahead of us on our 50th birthday of adulthood as we have come through before our 50th birthday, a second adulthood. Between the first and the second adulthood lies what I call the fertile void, where we spend up to a year or more lost between the two worlds. Each of us tumbles down what feels like Alice's rabbit hole in our own way at our own pace. My friend Jane, for example, retired in her 50s from an executive job. She wasn't sure what she was going to do next. First thing that happened was that life intervened. Her mother got sick and died. Then she began taking consulting projects. They didn't seem to be heading her in the right direction. And she tried several things, and she is now enrolled in seminary. Neither she nor anybody who knew her would have predicted that. That's what the fertile void does. In the fertile void, we flounder around, we experiment, we stir things up, and sooner or later, every woman hears herself say, "You know what? I don't care what people think anymore." That unladylike behavior is the beginning of what I call the fuck you 50s. The other part of the I don't care what people think statement is really that I do care what other people think, but I care more what I think. That rebelliousness frees us from the shoulda, woulda, coulda kind of thinking that has set our course for our first adulthood. My first step into the fertile void was backwards off a 90-foot cliff. How I got there was one of those impetuous risks that I've been talking about, that we take at this stage. I had been a tomboy, but like many women, I had traded strength for coyness. And somehow this tomboy emerged and got me to sign up for an Outward Bound program. Outward Bound. Anybody here done Outward? Okay, then I won't go through all the things we did before the last day. When we were led through this lovely forest, and there was a clearing in the distance, and I thought, oh, this is so nice. We're going to sit around and bond and exchange addresses and all of that. But no. At the edge of the clearing lay a row of sinisterly coiled ropes at the edge of nothing. Dumb with terror, I let myself be suited up in full rappelling gear to walk down what could have been the face of my 12-story apartment building. It was not very reassuring, although it was meant to be, when our instructor said, "Fear is a totally normal response." He said, "After all, evolution doesn't look kindly on creatures that step backwards off 90-foot cliffs." So I stepped backwards off a 90-foot cliff. And I made it down, of course, shaken but in one piece. And I understood that I had learned a very important lesson. But my real breakthrough came later. As the group gathered below the cliff and kind of just took a deep breath, our instructors came over and said they had another assignment. It was time, they said, to climb back up. Maybe it was because I was so totally wrecked physically and emotionally, but I think it was overcoming the fear on the way down that gave me the courage to speak up, to listen to the voice calling out from within, to say no to going back up. That no was the loudest sound I had ever made. It stirred more emotions than the whole feat that I had just performed. For what felt like the very first time, I said what I meant. I did what I needed to do rather than what I was expected to do. The first surprise was that it wasn't the end of the world. "Okay," said the instructor, "the path up is over there." Imagine how many other things in my life could have been simple. For me, that was really the beginning of the process of reinventing myself, one no at a time. Every no gave me the courage and the self-awareness to begin saying yes with authenticity and authority. I really believe that fluency in no and the true ring of yes are the basis of every choice we make in second adulthood, and particularly the basis on which we evaluate our relationships going forward. No, that's not who I am. Yes, that's what I want. Yes, that's somebody I want to get to know. This means that every relationship is up for review, and every recalibration is a second chance. With every choice, you are becoming who you are going to be going forward and leaving behind who you were. I think one of the most important messages to keep in mind is that throughout this whole process, actually for the rest of your life, you are not who you were, only older. The process can be very painful. Marriages flounder on their staleness or toxicity. Friendships are outgrown. Children become outraged that you are not available 24/7. And those who have counted on us for so long may become afraid that after all the changes we are going through, we won't love them the way we did before. In most cases, though, they and we learn to keep loving in a new, mutually nurturing way. This is what I call the new intimacy. We have many new life skills that foster positive feelings and good feelings about other people, make us more available to other people. Several studies have found that people in their 50s and 60s report that they are happier than people in their 30s. Now, that's certainly my experience. Why? Because we are better at handling the ups and downs of life. better at appreciating the glass half full, better at not sweating the small stuff, better at finding a third way. Our decision-making is less determined by win-lose, either-or, me-you distinctions. Instead, we get good at thinking in a both-and way. Resolving conflict, then, we are amalgamating pieces from several pies without choosing one and rejecting another. No wonder we are so ready for love. The new intimacy is about romantic love, but it is also about unconditional love, the love that people feel for their grandchildren. And it's about love for our friends, our circle of trust, that gaggle of women who get you, who watch your back, and who make you laugh. It's about work. It's about reconciliation. It's about sex. And it's about establishing a commitment to future generations. I can't talk about all these things now, but maybe we can touch on some later. But I will talk about a few. So how do we love now? Let me count a few ways. Romance. Women of our generation have really been all over the map with this one. We cannot deny that there are residues of the knight in shining armor image. A man who is older, taller, smarter, richer, and more powerful, who whisks us off our feet and gives us a life that we never could have had on our own. In this scenario, we are grateful, and he is powerful. The husband of one woman I know told her that he believed in the golden rule. He who makes the gold makes the rules. Nowadays, it's just as likely that we will be taller, older, more successful than a prospective partner. We don't need someone else to make a life for us. That widens the playing field in a lot of respects. For example, in terms of CVs. As one woman put it, I have a PhD, but he has a PhD in life. What happened to change the game was the 70s and the women's movement. As women moved into the real world, the damsel in distress was left behind. Bella Abzug, who I admire maybe more than anybody else, once observed, she had a great sense of politics, not only electoral politics, but personal politics. And politics is about power. So she was very aware of those kind of relationships. And she said that women of our generation had started out dependent on the rest of the world to make their lives. In the 70s, we got feisty and became independent. Ahead now, she said, lies another challenge, which is to get good at being interdependent with another person, to share power, to respect each other's strengths, and accept each other's weaknesses. You can't get that with a knight in shining armor. Instead, women I've talked to are looking for something that wasn't on their list before. I call it the niceness factor. I can remember back when friends of mine would say, I'm going out with this guy, and he's really terrific, and he's funny, and he's easy to be with, but he's too nice. What exactly does that mean? Well, one thing I think it means is that the woman who is saying that doesn't feel that she's worth somebody being nice to. But it also plays into the game, the mating game that was prevalent in our early years. What kind of a jerk would give in to his feelings without being trapped? What kind of a jerk would give up without a fight? The chase is less interesting now. Trust and devotion are more important. Today, women know who they are, what they want, and what they deserve. The best expression of this kind of loving, comfortable interdependence comes from two women who had been married, raised children, and then, much to their amazement, fell in love in their 60s. That is not so unusual. When you realize that the playing field has expanded, there's no reason why it can't expand beyond gender. Here's what Amelia wrote. I feel equal when I'm with Grace. Our days aren't fraught with agonizing thoughts like, am I loved? Am I still loved? Are you going to leave me? If the real world playing field has expanded, the internet has opened up possibilities unimaginable before. All the qualities that we've been talking about, risk-taking, curiosity, assertiveness, self-definition, are all welcome in the expanded internet. Waiting by the phone for life to come calling is a thing of the past. You can have a different personality online. You can find somebody with matching proclivities online. You can find a partner online. And we've all heard of high school sweethearts who have been reunited by finding each other on Facebook. That happened to Donna Hanover, who was the unceremoniously dumped wife of Rudy Giuliani. And she wrote a book about it called My Boyfriend's Back. It also happened to a woman named Meg, who fell in love with Mark in college. They thought it was the real thing. But Mark began to panic. And first he broke up with her, and then he moved across the country. She went on and got married and had two children. He went on and got married and got divorced and got married and got divorced. And 40 years later, they found each other on Facebook. And they began to re-find each other. And finally, although they had not met in 40 years, Meg left her husband, got in her car, drove across the country, and moved in with Mark. And they are the happiest people I know. And she says, it's very simple. He was always the love of my life. When I talk about these new relationships, the question waiting to be asked is the one that Ms. Magazine posed on a cover in the early 70s. How's your sex life? Better? Worse? I forget. They always said the women's movement had no sense of humor, but that's not so. If age is something to be ashamed of, as we are led to believe, then isn't sex between two aging bodies even more unpleasant to contemplate? The truth is that some women do want to forget. Been there, done that, they want to focus on other pleasures. Other women have no choice, and they go about their lives finding fulfillment in other areas and other forms of intimacy. They have no intention on settling on some guy who thinks he's God's gift to women. I'll be damned, one woman told me, if I'm going to become a nurse with a purse to some guy. But the big revelation for me in researching this book is that has been that for all the bemoaning of no men out there, no sex out there, no libido, more women than you think are having great sex. They're having great sex for the same reason that they are having a great second adulthood. They are entering relationships with confidence and curiosity. Actually, there's no better measure of a self-confidence than the fact that a woman who is all too aware of her sags and bulges will still go for it. My favorite scene that embodies this spirit of discovery is in the movie It's Complicated with Meryl Streep. You probably remember this scene. She's been divorced from this guy for a long time. They reconnect. They have a wild night of passion. And the next morning, he gets up and waddles off to the bathroom in all his fleshy glory. She gets up and wraps the sheet around herself. And he turns around and he says, "Why are you doing that? We were naked last night." "Ah," she says, "but we were lying down." I've talked to women who were happy to settle in with a guy who is good company and affectionate. That's great sex by their lights. Others want drums and rockets. Some report experiencing great sex for the first time. Some report experiencing great sex with their long-term partners. Many don't have any expectations beyond a learning experience, which is why so often you hear about older women and younger men. Psychologists have watched these kind of relationships and concluded that there is more equality here than you might think. For a woman, it's a chance for a sexual interlude with no strings. For the younger man, it's a chance to be with an experienced woman with no strings. Of course, the danger in this transaction is that one or the other begins to want to get more from the relationship. The chances for real compatibility are still better between people of the same generation. And nature, I am always fascinated when I'm researching these subjects, how frequently nature turns out to have tilted things to our advantage. In this case, what many consider a loss, a hormonal decline, is really, in this respect, a gain. We all know that women lose estrogen at menopause. But when the estrogen is moved out of the picture, the testosterone that women have always had is, as they say, unmasked. And this may account for some of the assertiveness and adventuresomeness that we are experiencing. But here's where nature got really terrific. At the same time, men's testosterone is going down, which makes them more accepting and tender and less aggressive and ambitious. So I call this hormonal compatibility. Hormonal compatibility may play a role in the way long-standing marriages evolve at this stage. Of course, many don't evolve. We know that over 50% of the divorces initiated by people over 50 are initiated by women. Women who have had it, and once the children are gone, they want to get on with a life of their own. Other women settle in for the duration with a relationship that holds few surprises, but has a long history and is comfortable and reliable. One of the major challenges of the new intimacy is renegotiating a long-term marriage. No matter what kind of intimacy a couple achieves, getting there involves some intense truth-telling about expectations. The truth will set you free, it has been said, but first it will piss you off. This is a stressful time, especially for empty nesters. For many, when the children have gone, there is suddenly time and privacy to explore what is there or not there in the relationship. One common dynamic is a couple in which the man is winding down his career, looking forward to traveling, maybe pursuing some secondary careers, but basically spending more time together. Meanwhile, the woman is raring to go. She wants to concentrate on her work, pursue new interests, maybe move to a new community. Not easy plans to synchronize. Then there are those like my husband and I who have been basically inventing our marriage all along, not because we liked the process, but because we couldn't get it right. Second adulthood gave us a second chance. For me, the first 37 years were the hardest. We started way off the mark. That was back before I got good at saying no. And it wasn't only worry on my part that he would disapprove if I said no, but I had stifled my no so successfully that frequently I didn't know what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go, whereas he always knew. When we had children, the differences between us became magnified in our very different parenting styles. In the past few years, I am here to report that I have fallen in love all over again with the same man, though neither of us is really the same, only older. I do believe that he has mellowed, and I know that I have become more forthright and decisive. We have better fights. We make better decisions. But most of all, we have let go of the hope that either of us can change the other. We are both more independent. We occasionally travel separately. We regularly have dinner with friends. And we just generally give each other more room to maneuver. When we go on our separate ways, it is very nice to come home to each other. Here comes another nature thing. Did you know that as we age, the brain becomes more selective about responding to bad things? Not giant tragedies. I mean, if somebody falls in front of a train, you're not going to look the other way. But the minor things, the things that we used to say, oh, it ruined my whole day, the brain filters those out. At the same time as we are neutralizing bad things in the present, we are shedding bad things from the past. We all find ourselves letting go of grudges, letting go of disappointed experiences. We find as we revise old relationships and build new ones that we are less judgmental and more accepting of ourselves and of others. You might say that all of us are rejoicing in the glass half full. None of this is very easy, and our efforts may not pay off. Moreover, circumstances, illness or financial reversals, may undermine our best intentions. It's ironic that just as we come to a point in our lives where we can begin to focus on ourselves, and as one woman told me, go out of the emotional management business, we are often called upon to become caretakers all over again. Aging parents, children who come home, a sick partner. But it's still possible to practice the new golden rule that Gloria Steinem is promoting. Do unto yourself as you have been doing unto others. That's a variation on the oxygen mask metaphor. You know, when they tell you on the plane that when the mask drops down, put your own on first. And every mother finds that so counterintuitive that I can't imagine actually doing it. But attending to our own breathing, whether it means asking for help or whether it means learning what we really want and going for it, is what makes the new intimacy possible. This is not selfish. Respect for oneself is the basis of becoming a person who is real enough and old enough to know what love is. I will leave you with the words of Byron Katie. She says, romantic love is the story of how you need another person to complete you. It is an absolutely insane story. My experience is that I need no one to complete me. And as soon as I realize that, everyone completes me. Thank you very much. I hope that we can have a time for a conversation.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We want to thank Suzanne Ron Levine, author of How We Love Now. And your book is available afterwards. Will you sign?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. All right. We'll all see you there. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and I'm sure we have questions, so we want to open up a question period. We'd also like to remind our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You are listening to Suzanne Braun Levine, and I wonder if we don't have a question. Candice, will you pass the microphone? Thank you.
Please speak into the microphone so that the listening audience can hear your question.
Actually, I don't think it's questions. We all know what our lives are about. But I'd love to hear some comments. How do you love now? Does this make sense?
Yeah, I really identify with what you say. I've written a book called Husbands May Come and Go, But Friends Are Forever.
Great.
But I think to your point, I admire people, and I have lots of friends who have been married 40, 50 years, and still do love each other. And I think that's such a phenomenon, and I'm wondering how you describe that happens. Is it because you feel that people do change and they accept each other as you and your husband have done?
Yeah, but I am not sure that enduring 37 years that didn't quite work was something to be congratulated for. You know, people always say, oh, you've been married so long. That's wonderful. It's not necessarily. I mean, I think in our case, it was worth the payoff. But I don't think sticking together is necessarily in and of itself such a great thing. But people do find ways to fit together. They do. You see couples and they walk the same. You know, they tilt a little. They look the same. So, I mean, there is something that really binds people together over time, I think.
You know, I have a whole lot of girlfriends that are unattached, you know, that are really, really searching for that mate that maybe they never had or they used to have, but now they're 65, 70, and they want more than anything in the world, it seems, to fall in love again. And my heart goes out to them in some ways. It's like, God, I hope they find someone. And I wonder, will they? You know, in your interviews with people and looking at this, is there someone out there for everyone, or are there going to be a lot of women and men who really go on into the unknown without that ideal mate? And is that just life, or is there something that we can, some way to think about that that's mm-hmm. accepting to us?
Well, I think it's both. There are people who are going to go through life and always have been, who just missed the person they should have met. But I cannot tell you how many love stories I heard. And I had the feeling that people weren't telling them because either they didn't want to jinx them or they didn't want to seem to be lording it over their friends who were feeling lonely. I also cannot tell you how many people met the love of their life on internet dating sites. It's phenomenal. I know a mother and daughter who both met the love of their life on the same site. It's just amazing. And, you know, I sort of sneered at it, but it really is a way of reaching out. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of lying and misinformation. But boy, I was really impressed.
I just want to say thank you so much for what you said. And I think as a woman without a partner, that the person out there, the love of your life, is yourself. I know that sounds really narcissistic and Pollyannish, but that's where the high comes from and the exaltation. You can go on Facebook and dating sites every single day, every hour. That doesn't mean you're going to meet somebody. So I say the person that you're waiting for is yourself, and then anything can happen, like you say. Anyway,
well, there's
thank
a great
you.
Line from Marianne Moore where she says, "The best cure for loneliness is solitude." I love that one.
Given that you have a very successful marriage, as you describe it now, I wonder if you could say more about how you say the no from a place of love. In other words, how you say no and communicate your love for your husband at the same time.
Boy, that's... I think of a cartoon, and I'm not sure what my connection is, but there's a cartoon of a couple arguing, and he's saying, "I'm not shouting at you, I'm shouting with you." And somehow there... What that seems to suggest is that you're on the same side. And even though you are in conflict, that there is a baseline of goodwill and respect, which is not to say that a good knockdown, drag-out fight isn't probably a healthy thing. But I'll tell you what doesn't work is to say, "I love you, but I'm angry at you." I think it has to be there. It has to feel there. And that line from one of those women that are you going to leave me? Somehow the "are you going to leave me" has to be dealt with. I hadn't thought of this before, but I think that really, for me, has gone away finally. And maybe that's the underlying insecurity, that makes no so threatening?
Recently, and I don't remember where because I read a lot of different publications, I read about two different universities simultaneously doing studies on sexual satisfaction of seniors. Are you aware of them? And it was amazing to me that the level of satisfaction was far greater, older, than people in their 30s. So I just wondered.
Yeah, no, I saw that. I mean, I'll tell you something, though, and maybe I'd let the men here can enlighten us. That study was posted online, some website, and I commented on it. I said, yes, this is what I have found also, is that there are lots of juicy, lusty women out there. And there were a lot of really hostile comments from men. Yeah, right. And one man wrote, he said, oh, yeah, they're out there. I just saw one the other day. She was riding a unicorn. I was really surprised at the hostility to the notion that older people are having sex, want sex, and want it to be good. It's part of, I guess, the whole picture that, the ageism is everywhere, and it is even, especially when you have to picture an older person doing something unseemly. But I did see that, and there were two, actually. So two makes a pretty convincing argument.
Hi. What I want to ask you is that my biggest barrier, I've been single for a long time, and I thought, okay, after 50, I'm going to make myself, you know, I'm going to, oh, right. After 50, I'm going to live all my dreams and find Mr. Right. But the biggest barrier is age. I don't know if you found that in your research, if you have any words of wisdom about that. The moment they found out my age, they just run. They all these men, they seem to, that I come across, they all seem to want to meet women who are 15 to 20 years younger. And I so how do you deal with that? I mean, I'm disgusted with it.
You know, there's somebody
I have
did
lots of energy.
Terrific. No, I can tell. There's an interesting study somebody did that says men lie about their age more than women on the online profiles. That is a residue of the, knight in shining armor. He wants to be more taller, older, more powerful, and he's not going to find that with you. Our generation hasn't made it totally out of the 20th century. My daughter, I hope, will not have to deal with these things. But men and women carry a lot of these old expectations. And I am not sure that those men who are looking for really young women end up being all that happy with them, you know? I would think so. He said it makes you feel older. I would think that.
Hi, Suzanne. I have a question.
Hello, Marcy.
So you had a story that you recited about these two women who ended up together after leaving marriages to men. And the way you positioned that story, you made it seem like those two women, one of the reasons that they ended up together was that they felt some kind of security that they couldn't feel in these straight marriages. And it was just interesting to me that I was wondering if you're really suggesting that there are women who are ending up with other women later in life, not because they had any lesbian tendencies earlier, but because they really are making a practical decision or an emotional decision more than a sexual decision.
Well, it's certainly emotional. Pepper Schwartz, who is one of the longest living sexologist of our generation, analyzed this pattern by saying that women loved their friends, and for their whole lives they loved their friends. And they get to this stage, and they look around, and they say, who do I love? And it turns out to be a friend. I also did interview women who discovered their sexuality with other women. And the idea that people can explore in more directions than we used to, I think, is part of all this. But it's interesting. There are studies that show that homosexual couples fight better than heterosexual couples. The assumption being that they are, both parties are coming from the same place, that they aren't responding to baggage that, you know, this knight in shining armor may be responding to one kind of baggage, and the I don't like Mr. Nice woman from another, but that there is a certain empathy and compatibility that puts that kind of baseline under the relationship. But I wouldn't separate the sex and the emotion.
We've reached a point where we have time for one more question or comment, and we'd love to hear it. Anybody has that?
Well, you talk a lot about fighting, and I'm just wondering if you're trying to say that fighting in an intimate couple is inevitable, that it's constructive. I'm a little confused about that, because I've actually had a long-term relationship with somebody that I never had any conflict with. And even when she disapproved of something I said or did, she presented it in a way that it made me feel she was trying to help me. And we never fought. And I just don't know where that comes from and, you know, what my role is in it. So would you speak? You talked a lot about your husband.
Right, no, I'm certainly speaking from my own experience. I mean, I have lived in a very conflict-ridden universe, I guess. I live in New York. What can I tell you? But I do think that's the ideal. That is certainly the ideal. But what you had. But all I'm saying is that fighting can be a reflection of both parties asserting their authentic selves. And if that hasn't happened all along, when it happens, it can be, you know, stressful. But there's no reason why you have to go out and start a fight. No, I think you've described a situation ideally to be wished.
Our sincere thanks to Suzanne Braun-Levine. Author of How We Love Now, who will meet you at outside where we have books on sale. And we also thank our audience here as well as our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.